Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. We're back in the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros, and we are wrapping up our coverage of the second season of HBO's House of the Dragon. We'll be diving into all the treachery between Team Green and Team Black. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and our returning listeners will know that we're cousins who started this podcast because we love to talk about fantasy and sci-fi shows, and period pieces too, you know, we like bros as well. In the past, we've covered His Dark Materials, The Witcher, Avatar The Last Airbender, The Legend of Korra, Lovecraft Country, and Three Body Problem, and we loved every moment of it. This season, we have returned to the world of dragons and swords and horses, and it has been great.
Today, we're wrapping up our coverage of season 2 and discussing some of our biggest questions. Be advised, there will be spoilers from Game of Thrones, everything in House of the Dragon up to this point, some discussion about the events in Fire and Blood. However, we will not be spoiling future events from that book in the main podcast. We will, however, have a tiny, itty-bitty spoiler section, just so we can wildly speculate on the show's future.
And Kin Folklore will not leave you bemoaning the loss of adult content as Aegon bemoans the loss of private areas that burst into flames like sausage on a spit. We will have adult content. And so if you're here for content where it takes seeing your whole entire future of your line just so you can make up, so mom and dad can make up and get back together, and you've come to the right place.
I'm glad mom and dad are back together.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So let's just talk about how we feel about the season overall. How are you feeling?
I feel really good. We're almost 2 weeks out.
Yeah.
I feel really good.
Yeah,
now,
me too.
But I was big mad when it ended.
Really? Okay. Yeah,
I really had like a turn of feeling about it. I complained about the pacing the entire season. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I felt like they were going too fast. Like, give me more Jace and Cregan. Like, what are we doing? I want to see the Aerie. I want to see House Manderly, which like, whatever.
You wanted Lady Jane for sure. You were like, what the hell is happening? Where is she at? And more of her for sure.
Right. And then what we got of her was like entirely unsatisfactory.
Yeah.
However, towards the end, I felt like they were really slow rolling it. And I think even before the season came out, you and I had a conversation about, we knew that Rook's Rest was going to be episode 4 because it was mm-hmm. the one they were like hyping up. Mm-hmm. And I think originally, I don't know if it was a rumor or if HBO had actually called it that in the press, but it was supposed to be called The Dance of Dragons. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, here we go. We're going to see some dragons tussling. Mm-hmm. But then we were like, well, what the hell are they going to do with the rest of the season? Mm-hmm. Because we could not imagine that in 4 episodes they could get to the next biggest event, which we'll mention in the spoiler section, but not in the main podcast. And it did really feel like that. Like the rest of the season, they were kind of biding their time so that they didn't have to really have another big battle.
Yeah.
So I still feel like that was an issue. I'm not going to get into the whole meta conversation about 8 episodes versus 10, Discovery, HBO making mistakes. I just don't. I think no one listening to this podcast has not heard that. Like it's been the discourse for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I do think that the finale ended on a little bit of a what's going on. Is this a trailer for season 3? Like it wasn't that I didn't love the last 15 minutes of the finale, but I feel really good about what we got in terms of the magic, the lore, answering some of our questions, throwing in like Sarah Targaryen being Hugh's mother. That mm-hmm. was like a big moment for people who read and liked this book and like to speculate. So I'm grateful that we have that. But I'm not going to disagree with the fans who were let down by the final episode.
Okay. I'm going to push back a little bit on the disappointment about the last episode because we have as Exhibit A season 8 of the OG series. And we all were big mad that they went from saving the world to Daenerys burning down King's Landing within four episodes. Like we all were like, what the fuck just happened? And TV doesn't have a lot of tricks at their disposal and up their sleeve like movies have when it comes to budgets. And they have, you know, the gap is closed a little bit, but there's still some tricks that they don't have because of how many episodes they have to make. You're basically making a 60-minute feature film for 10 times or 8 times in this case. But the one thing they have that films will never have is time. They just have time. Like, novels have time. They have time to, like, set up stories, to set up plot lines, to give you more. And so my feeling about the last 15 minutes is I didn't think we needed everyone marching to war. We already know that that's happening. They probably could have left that. I mean, cool. I didn't love all the different theme music. That was, like, cool, build it. But I didn't see the end of this season outside of, you know, a dragon and a boy being killed much different than Rhaenyra staring into the camera like angry at the end. And I think that what they're doing is they're giving us the pacing that we need to be able to understand characters that would have just looked like explosions and people fighting next season. Like, without all the context of Adam and Alan and Hugh and Ulf and what happened with Alice and hearing all the conversations about Daron, understanding what that army is that's marching with that blue dragon, that all seems like exposition, but it's all super important. And we can't say everything of why, but it's important. And I think that while they're getting some blowback now, people will look back as this season being an important build-out season for the rest of what they show in what I think is going to be two more seasons.
I don't disagree with you. I just feel like some of it is a little bit of like how the show was marketed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a little bit of the discourse that from HBO and the showrunner, frankly, on leading into the season. And then, like, HBO was, they were the ones who did this, like, all must choose. It's going to be, like, all out war. Like, people expect actual conflict regularly. And I'm not saying there wasn't that, but it's like, I don't know. I don't disagree with you. I think this season's going to age very well. I understand the fans who felt let down.
Yeah, and I think, like, All Must Choose, to me, which I think they shouldn't have done the whole all-out war, but I like All Must Choose because by the end, where they end it, every single faction has chosen where they stand. Right, wrong, and different.
That's not true.
Oh, the Baratheons are kind of still out.
Well, where's House Tyrell?
Yeah, well, they never choose. How are we even talking about them?
But also, we got the Greyjoys out here. Like, there were houses that were mentioned that we don't know what they've chosen. But I see what you're saying. Yes. Yeah.
House Tyrell, like, they're, I mean, Marjorie was able to pick Renly, then flip-flop and end up with Joffrey, then be like, you know, your brother's kind of cute and end up with the brother. Like, I mean, they never fucking choose. They're like, they're about the Tyrells, you know? So it's crazy. I feel you. I don't want to, like, you know, make light of fans being disappointed. I do think that, like, one thing that the show has to fix, I don't know if they will be able to, is that a lot of times people are upset because I can say, oh, well, you know, they're taking their time. They're slow rolling it because we don't want to be disappointed like what happened with Dany. But that's because I've read the greater book. And not everybody watching the show is reading the book. And so I think it's unfair to just assume that people have done the homework. And I think the show did that a lot this season. They just assumed people did the homework. You know what I mean?
Or that they're going to listen to a podcast or that they're going to go onto the wiki.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way of writing, but I don't think it's always effective here. Like, there's like a conversation that the show is having with the greater audience, which is who I think the show is written for, and the book readers. And it's not always one that I think is working well for them. But I will say, I think the in talking to people in the postseason, the majority of people who are upset are non-book readers. I feel like some book readers felt like we got a lot of meat here. And that's ultimately how I landed, which was like, all right. So yeah. We didn't get to see more dragon fights, which also fine. Leave the baby dragons alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except for Vhagar. She got to go. But leave the other dragons alone.
Go. Yeah, for sure.
But like we got so much more. Like the finale, like kind of like broke my brain and just like how much magic was in it.
And I love that. The magic has been great. And I know we're going to get to that in a minute, but I that was the main thing that I thought Dan and Dave never were able to do in Game of Thrones, where the magic was always way, way down on the political like maneuvering and the way the war played out, like as far as like strategy, sex position. Magic was always like way far down. And I love that this show has really leaned into the magic in a way that I think the series needs, you know? Mm-hmm. That's really great about it.
Agreed.
I also love the acting. I thought the acting was great in this series. I thought there was some really, really good acting. Even small characters were good in the small council room. There was some good stuff. But I mean, let's talk about a few that really. Tom Glenn Carney. Oh my gosh! Wow, like his portrayal of Aegon is just like. Yeah, I think you wanted to see him on the screen, and I thought that it captured all of the complexity of the character, you know? And you don't like Aegon, but you understand more about who this character is in a way that I don't think was you know, I just think he brought it alive. And I think part of it is I just hearing some of his takes, I think he's taking positions about Aegon that most watchers wouldn't. And I think one of the first rules when you're portraying a character like this is like, don't judge the character, and you have to find the humanity in the character. And I think that he did that really well.
I think he's the most Thronesian character.
Yeah.
Because he is very complex. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like Aegon. Because largely because of stuff that he did in season one.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't hate him as much anymore. I do see his humanity. And that's kind of how I felt about Jaime. Mm-hmm. Like, I was never a big Jaime stan because you can't really have a redemption tour from throwing a child out of the window for me. Mm-hmm. Even if that child ends up being a supervillain. But anyway. Yeah. I never really had that, but I do remember in season 7 of Game of Thrones when Daenerys and Jaime face off and Drogon is about to light him up, I genuinely gasped. I wasn't mm-hmm. ready to part with, even though I was Team Dany all the way, I was genuinely worried about Jaime's safety in a way that surprised me. And I think that that's what Tom Glenn Carney has done with Aegon. He's made him a character that I don't like. I might be happy to see him die, or at least it feels that way. But I'm kind of sad that that version of Aegon is gone from the story.
Yeah.
Because whatever Aegon we get next is not going to be the egg that we had all season.
Yeah.
So I like he's definitely changed the way I feel about Aegon.
Yeah, I agree. I that's how I felt too. And I guess, you know, let's talk about his wife. I think Fia Saban did an amazing job this season. I thought she was phenomenal. From that terrible scene where baby Jaehaerys dies, throughout the way that she like her time on the screen always was believable too. From that moment all the way to when she's telling Aemon what's going to happen to him, I just think it's she's just did a masterful job.
Oh, totally. I think in a lot of ways, Thea Saban made Helaena a real character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think George gave Helaena's character much thought because I think that George really wanted to center this conflict on the princess and the queen.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a, you know, another princess or another queen, I think he felt it might muddle the waters a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that Thea Sabon has stepped like outside of this conflict. Like she is other than the greens or the blacks. Mm-hmm. And she is a fan favorite, but she's just also putting in like a performance that is just otherworldly, frankly.
Yeah.
Like, agreed. It's not hard to see that Alice and Helena are connections to whatever magical world there is, because both of those actresses gave otherworldly performances. So I thought she was great.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. What do you think of Old One Eye?
I think Ewan Mitchell, even though I still hate Eamon, will always hate Eamon, have hated Eamon before the show came on. Like, a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't have feelings about Eamon before. Oh, I did. I came into this story hating Eamon. I hated Eamon when he was a little kid, okay? I was fine with the bullying, okay? I mean, that's not actually true, but, like, I never liked Eamon as a character, but Ewan Mitchell had 30 minutes of screen time this season, and just what? Like, this whole season, Eamon was like a character lurking in the background. Like, the scene where he realizes that Damon was actually looking, they were actually, Blood and Cheese were looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say anything, and it's such a mm-hmm. good performance. I just think Ewan Mitchell is an incredible talent for the show. I have to say, I might complain about so much of the issues around storytelling. I might even complain about the CGI. I definitely will complain about the wigs. But the casting and the costuming on this show are like flawless. And they nailed it with this casting. He is so good. He is a perfect, like, opposite to Matt Smith's Damon.
I mean, and it's kind of wild for me because I am a Last Kingdom Uhtred, Son of Uhtred fan. I love that show. And so he's like Osferth. He's like a like monk, kind of like warrior monk in that show. And he's so much younger. So when I first saw him, I was just like, oh my gosh, like that's Osferth, but he has totally, I don't even think about Osferth anymore. Like, I just look at him and see, like, now it's like, it's a distant memory. So as a fan of just him as an actor, that he's been able to really become Eamon One Eye, even to someone who watched him in other shows, is a testament to like how good a job he's done, you know?
So, totally. Very amazing performance. I'm here for all of it. You know what's crazy about this show? We'll talk about Emma Darcy in a minute, but like, Olivia Cooke would be on any other show one of the standout performances.
Mm-hmm.
Olivia Cooke's great in this show. I'm not complaining about her performance, but it's just, there's so many other performances that kind of overshadow it.
Yeah. I mean, I thought she was great in the final scene with her and Rhaenyra, you know? But yeah, I agree. I think there's some really strong performances outside of that. I think that, I mean, this is all the way around. There's some really strong performances. I mean, even when you get to, you know, Eve Best, and you get to Steve, and you get, I know it's, I mean, even like, you know, the two Valarian boys now, they're doing a great job. So there's some really good actors on this show. But, you know, we got to give it up because they carry the show in a lot of ways. Emma Darcy. Wow.
I just, again, stunning. Yeah. just sure. cannot help but watch their portrayal of Rhaenyra in awe. I don't, like, Emma Darcy took Rhaenyra from a character that I really wanted to root for to a character that I'm like, sure, yeah, I'll join the dragon cult. Fine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Never. 100%. Yeah. Okay. So she had to sacrifice, you know, a few dozen people. It's cool. She, like, I just think it's such a, it has such depth, and you see that come out the most when they are with their favorite screen partners, Matt Smith and Olivia Cooke.
Yes. Yes. 100%.
Emma nailed both of those scenes.
Yes, I agree. I mean, all of those scenes, the one with the argument, the one in the in Harrenhal, the one in back in Dragonstone, like you say, I thought the two Daemon Targaryen scenes, like that, like you said when we were recording it the first time, that seemed like a real argument between a real married couple. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like, you know, we were looking, it was fascinating, you know. And yeah, they really did a good job on this this season, and in general, you know, like you said, stunning, just a complete icon. Complete icon. So
I did want to just have you pick your breakout character from the season. I think I have one. We might have the same one.
I mean, there's only one. Sir Simon Strong.
Sir Simon Strong.
I mean, there's really only one.
Like, yeah, there's just... listen, I'm all for Shakar Lohan. Like, yeah. I love Abigail Thorne's performance, even though I didn't love the stuff with the Triarchy. I love the performance overall. They're, obviously, also, Laris did not have that much screen time, but when he was on screen, I was more interested. But Simon Strong... From the moment he kneeled to Daemon to the moment he snitched on Daemon, that's my heart right here. No. Simon is the man.
I know when he's like up seizing the castle, and he was like, "Well, yes, obviously. Like, would you like some mutton? Like, what would you like?" he got through with the formalities of bending the knee super fast. Like, he was like, "Okay, cool."
Good stuff. Yeah. Love.
Yeah, it's great. It's or the one of the best moments was when the Blackwood was about to get killed, and he's like, "Oh dear."
And also, I don't think we spend enough time talking about this man's fit. Drip.
His drip is phenomenal.
The reason Harrenhal doesn't have any money is because of Sir Simon uses all the money for his clothes. The man just looks sharp in every scene.
Oh man.
He's like, "The surroundings might be drab, but it doesn't mean I have to be."
He said, and I love that he was like, I love that he was talking about like how wet it was in Harrenhal and how that was crazy that there was a fire, like how the hell it was. But meanwhile, his clothing is like immaculate. No mildew, no nothing. No, it's like, no,
not even a crease.
Yeah.
He's out here wearing velvets in the humid weather. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's wild. It's super wild. So let's talk about, we're going to transition and talking a little bit about magic here. It's one of our favorite topics. It's a fantasy show. But let's talk about one of the first things that have, you know, flipped this whole world on its head since season one of this show. And it's the prophecy. Do you think that they've muddled some of the themes of the OG kind of like of the OG show Game of Thrones with this prophecy? What are your thoughts? And I know you were really like, yeah, I liked it. You were really kind of like having some struggles with the whole, the dagger and the prophecy. Where are you at now in season two?
I'm like super torn about it, because if we didn't have the prophecy, we wouldn't have this conversation between House of the Dragon and A Song of Ice and Fire, the original series. But the flip side is, I think some of the problem with the show and why some audiences are turned off is, one, continuing to bring up The Long Night is reminding people of season 8, which is a thing that is 5 years behind. We want to move on.
Yeah.
we don't want to talk about it anymore. And two, I think that this could have been a story about two women vying for power. And because of the prophecy, they've actually made it the opposite. It's no longer about a power struggle between Queen Alicent and Princess Rhaenyra. And it's more about two women who are trying to do everything to avoid war who are not that interested in power, who are only interested in the power from Rhaenyra's point of view because of this prophecy, because her father told her about this prophecy. I think it takes a little bit of the main theme of the story away, because all of the men are terrible and want blood, and the women are just like, Helena and Rhaenyra are directly moving through the world based on this prophecy. And then you have Allison, who now that she knows about the prophecy, although I don't think she fully understands it. Like, I think she knows that there was a prophecy driving Viserys's decision, and she's trying to honor, she thinks that she's honoring that in some way, but she, I don't think that she actually understands what the Princess's Promise means. But they're all like, they're supposed to be like good because they're trying to avoid doom. And then all the guys are like, whatever, we don't know about this prophecy. We don't, like, we're just trying to fuck some shit up.
Yeah,
I
don't think that that's the fault of the prophecy, though. I think that that's the fault. So I hear, because I agree with what you're saying. I think that's the fault of the perspective of the writers. Even though they've brought more women into the writers' room, I honestly think that Ryan Condal, even from last year, when he was like, you know, Rhaenys didn't burn them all because she's a mother, that always stuck with me. Of like, yeah, you have a perception of what, you know, women in leadership are, like who they are, and that may not be the right perception, bro. And I just don't know if I totally agree with you that them not making it a story that was like firmly about what they advertised it as, which I think that's where you were going even earlier, of like a power struggle between Allison and Rhaenyra that is really about power, like how Cersei was really about power. I think that does take some of the bite out of the show, but I think that's less the prophecy than how they're using the prophecy, because I think that's where the torn is, as I kind of hear what you're saying, because we know that this prophecy, like we've talked at length, you and I even offline, how this prophecy may be the thing that's actually driven the Targaryens to all of this madness, that quote unquote madness that people call about them. And we'll talk more about that. But yeah, I feel you. I think I have a real problem with the way that they framed the conflict. And I don't know how I feel about the prophecy's part in it. I think like the conflict is definitely like not framed the way that it was in the books. You know,
yeah, okay. I think you're right. I think it's less about the prophecy and it's more about their use of the prophecy.
Yeah.
Like, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that they needed a way to tie this to the original series for those original fans. But I also think Ryan Condal has some ideas about the prophecy. And people can continue to send me links to articles and argue with me about the Princess Promise. But I'm going off of what was shown on screen and what is in the books. And I think, even if Ryan Condal's not trying to like put his thumb on the scale, although I don't agree, I do think that he has a vision of what this story is about and what the prophecy might mean for the story. And so,
yeah, I just think George was just in his DMs like, yo, bro, like, what are you doing? Like, can you not do this right now? Like, really? I got dragons in the fucking Vale. I got this going on. Like, hey. So I think George got on his case, based on what you just said about Ryan Condal's idea, we were talking before the show, would you mind, like, I think that this passage that you read me about Maester Aemon and the prince that was promised in his conversation with Sam is absolutely like, it's one of the things that I think is like, been driving a lot of the conversation that you and I have been having, but also I think it'd be good for the fandom to hear, like, if they haven't read it, what Maester Aemon, who everyone loves and trusts, says about this prophecy.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people have been arguing with me about it, for the most part, I've been pointing them to Maester Aemon. Mostly, like, go argue with the Maester. Like, I don't... All right, so... this passage that we were talking about offline comes from A Feast for Crows, and it's from one of Sam's chapters. He's on his way to Old Town. a trip that he's taking essentially because Maester Aemon wanted to get information to Old Town. Sam is reflecting on what Maester Aemon said to him. That's where the quote starts. "No one ever looked for a girl," he said. That's Maester Aemon talking to Sam. "It was a prince that was promised, not a princess. Rhaegar, I thought. The smoke was from the fire that devoured Summerhall on the day of his birth. The salt from the tears shed for those who died. He shared my belief when he was young, but later he became persuaded that it was his own son who fulfilled the prophecy. For a comet had been seen above King's Landing on the night of Aegon was conceived. And Rhaegar was certain the bleeding star had to be a comet. What fools we were who thought ourselves so wise. The error crept in from the translation. Dragons are neither male or female. Barf saw the truth of that. But now one and now the other, as changeable as flame. The language misled us all for 1,000 years. Daenerys is the one, born amidst smoke and salt. The dragons prove it. Just talking of her seemed to make him stronger. I must go to her. I must. Would that I were 10 years younger." So Maester Aemon thought that Dany was the princess that was promised too. There's also, like, honestly.
And then Septon Barth is also who George says is right and accurate, right? This is
mostly
what we
right.
Mostly
like,
right.
I don't, want, yeah. don't come at us because yeah. He did say mostly right. Got it right.
Yeah. So these are very strong points towards what we see in the show, in the prophecy, inside of the vision that Daemon has about Dany being the princess that was promised. This does not negate John's importance to the story
at all.
Like it just.
I feel like the John stands, and I have a lot of feelings about John. They're mostly mostly because of season 8. They're mm-hmm. not fair to book John at all. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of fans feel like that when we're saying that we believe that Dany is a princess that was promised, that we're saying that John is, none of it matters of John. I'm absolutely not saying that. Mm-hmm. John is going to play an extremely important role if we ever get these books, as is Bran, obviously, as is Arya, as is Sansa, as is Tyrion. These characters are all super important. And I agree that John and Dany, this is their story. I just mm-hmm. think they have different roles in their story. In the
100%. This both of their stories, but they have different roles in the story. And I just think, you know, this plays into one of the things that we've been talking about. And I think it's, you know, also important because before this vision, Daemon sees a green man. And one of the things that you and I have been talking about is, how are the old gods involved in the manipulation of the way that this story plays out? Because we're going to talk a little bit about the Green Man, and I'll bring this back full circle. But the reason I'm bringing this up now is because I do believe that this vision and seeing what's going to happen in the future and seeing Dany so clearly and seeing the Green Man has something to do with the Targaryen madness that goes on, has something to do with the events that lead to the war in Robert's Rebellion, has something to do with some of the things that we see in the dance. There's a lot here. So talk a little bit first, before we get too deep into this, about the Green Man and the appearance of the Green Man and who the Green Men are.
So we're going back to when the First Men and the Children of the Forest were warring. I'm not going to rehash how the war went down, but they decided to come to peace. There was a pact between them. That pact was signed in the God's Eye on the Isle of Faces. Hmm. And the children... So the First Men, I guess I do have to get into this. One of the things that the First Men did was they chopped down a bunch of weirwood trees. Hmm. Like, because they felt that the weirwood trees were allowing the children to spy on them, communicate, whatever. So a bunch of weirwood trees were cut down. So the children and the first men come together to have this pact on the Isle of Faces, and the children carve a face into every weirwood tree on the isle, so that the old gods could witness the pact. And then the Order of the Green Men was established to protect the Isle of Faces. So the Isle of Faces is in the middle of the God's Eye, which is a lake right next to Harrenhal. And people don't visit it. It's a sacred place and people don't go there. There's an understanding that if you try to get there, you won't be able to get there. But we do have two characters who we know may have been there. I won't get to that yet, but what I will say is that this hooved with a person, maybe human, with like antlers that we saw right before Damon saw his vision, is, we believe, is a green man. Are the green men human? We don't know. Like, we're not really sure. Mm-hmm. We're like, also, some people don't believe that the green men are even around anymore. I think the show is confirming to us that they most definitely are. Because that was before Damon's vision. So mm-hmm. I believe what he saw was real. And what we heard was real, because we could hear the little like clip clopping of mm-hmm. the hooves. Is it a costume, or is it that they're non-human? I'm not really sure. Like, maybe they're some kind of humanoid species. We're not clear. But we first learn of the green men in the main book through, well, Bran is talking about them. He's learned from old Nan. And Mira and Jojen and him are talking about the Isle of Faces.
Yeah. And I think that we know that there are two characters, as you said, one we cannot talk about and one that we can, that has seen the Green Men been to the Isle of Faces. And that character is Jojen and Mira's dad, Howland Reed. So that leads to what we were talking about what is the role of the old gods, because Howland Reed was actually going to the Isle of Faces, went there, and on his way back from the Isle of Faces, was then in attendance at the tourney at Harrenhal. And, you know, Andrew and I were talking a little bit before the pod. It appears and feels like that his attendance at the tourney was kind of secondary and almost accidental, or was it accidental, to after he visited with the Green Men. So are they actually putting him in that place? Because this is the same tourney where where Rhaegar meets Lyanna, where they fall in love, apparently. He brings her to tears with the song that he sung. This is also where there's a mysterious knight that shows up and bests the people who were picking on Howland Reed. So, you know, it begs it, you start to wonder, this is where people in the realm saw Aerys Targaryen and started to think, oh, maybe something's off with this guy, right?
He hadn't cut his nails in years.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, the Green Men may play a role in this, and they're telling, and Howland Reed, you know, unbeknownst to him, is there from the beginning when, you know, Rhaegar and Lyanna meet, all the way to the Tower of Joy, where Lyanna dies, and he's there, you know, possibly to bear witness. But I think even more, because we don't still know why Howland Reed sent Mira and Jojen to accompany Bran on his journey. And I think that that's a key thing here. And we also know that how the whole battle went down at the Tower of Joy, he played a pivotal role that was kept secret, that never was shared, according to the show, with anybody in the realm until Bran saw it for himself. So I think there's a lot here to unpack. So
yeah, I just think that like the show has me for sure, and I don't know if other people feel this way, but like wondering about the role of the old gods in new ways. Like, I think we've always understood, just based on what we saw in the show and based on what is in the original books, obviously the weirwood tree is a powerful tool of the old gods. Obviously green seeing and all of that is our abilities from the old gods. What I think the show has done to make me rethink this is mixed it with Targaryen mm-hmm. dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a lot of dreamers. Like mm-hmm. there's what we used to think was a rare ability, Targaryen dreaming. The show is maybe proposing to us that maybe it's not that rare. Maybe a lot of Targaryens are also dreamers. Not all of them. Like, I don't think we have any evidence whatsoever that Daenerys's Viserys, her older brother, is a dreamer. Mm. But it's certainly putting into question Maester Aemon says he's a dreamer and says that his brothers were, but like, it's putting into question like other Targaryens that I was never sure about, and definitely has me questioning, was Aerys a dreamer? And I certainly think Rhaegar was. And so the reason I think all this stuff with Howland Reed and like the Green Men and all, it's just making me like, where is a Targaryen gift for dreaming coming from? Is it from the same magic as green seeing?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the pact earlier, and I think like, it's interesting because I think that, you know, the pact remained through the Age of Heroes, the first Long Night, and was that way all the way until the Andals arrived to the Seven Kingdoms and brought the Faith of the Seven. And, you know, we were talking a little bit, and it's like, well, are the old gods the only gods, or are the old gods like now lashing out and creating these kind of things in prophecy and talking to the Targaryens and doing all that in revolt to the breaking of the pact? Like, that is a real thing to consider. Like, right? Like that the Andals came bringing these new gods, and maybe even their gods are wrong. You know what I mean? Like, that is a real thing to consider. And I don't know. I find it fascinating to speculate on the fact that this could be a war not only between the humans that we're seeing on the screen, but also mythical gods and creatures that are pissed off about what has gone down and moving these pieces on the board, much like Helena was insinuating.
Yeah, I think it's something we want to keep an eye on, because for a long time I wondered about R'hllor and the old gods.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have two characters from the main series who have the gift of foresight.
Mm-hmm.
Melisandre
mm-hmm.
and Bran. And I never really thought of Daenerys as being someone with the gift of foresight, but she also is. But she often gets those through some kind of conduit. And it's usually when she's actually dreaming. So I always wondered, like, is R'hllor actually just a monotheistic way of looking at the old gods?
Mm.
Perhaps. But now I'm also thinking about, like, are the Valyrian magic as well? Where, like, what is the root of that? We just, like, don't have enough information. And so if I separate out the Valyrian gods and the Valyrian magic, and I just look at the Targaryens, it does feel as if the old gods have been kind of meddling with the Targaryens for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to know more about it. I'm very curious about it. I think the show is certainly introducing that possibility. Maybe it's not, maybe this is nothing that George would have ever considered, right? But mm-hmm. we do have the mixing of old god magic and the Targaryens through one figure, which is Bloodraven.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there's something there. I don't think it's an accident.
Yeah, and he's in the vision, right? Yeah. Like so, and we also know that this prophecy has haunted the Targaryens since the beginning, since Aegon decided he was coming, since he made a new pact that's mentioned with the king in the north and got him to bend the knee, the king who knelt, and all of these things. But we know that this prophecy, I mean, maybe the prophecy is what brought down House Targaryen in the first place, because you got to ask the question, would Robert's Rebellion have happened if Rhaegar wasn't attempting to bring back this whole, the dragons has three heads, you know, because he had two, Princess Rhaenys and his toddler daughter and Prince Aegon, but he was looking for another Aegon or his Visenya. So let's look at Dany's vision, right, in the House of the Undying from Clash of Kings, and then we'll talk about it.
So this is a direct quote from the House of the Undying, and like people who only watch Game of Thrones who did not read the books, I think it would behoove you to go back and just read, if you don't want to read the whole book, just read the vision that's in the book, because it's fascinating. It's really interesting. And Game of Thrones had to take a lot of out of it because she does see the Red Wedding. And obviously they were like, we're not going to spoil our biggest thing. Like,
yeah, exactly.
So they took some of it out because it was spoilers. They took other parts of it out because out of context, it wouldn't have made much sense. But here's what it says. Viserys was her first thought the next time she paused, but a second glance told her otherwise. The man had her brother's hair, but he was taller and his eyes were dark indigo instead of lilac. Aegon, he said, to a woman nursing a newborn babe in a great wooden bed. What better name for a king? Will you make a song for him? The woman asked. He has a song, the man replied. He is the prince that was promised, and his is a song of ice and fire. He looked up when he said it, and his eyes met Dany's, and it seemed as if he saw her standing there beyond the door. There must be one more, he said, though whether he was speaking to her or the woman in the bed, she could not say. The dragon has three heads.
So what do you think about that? Where do you think that?
So it begs the question, this prophecy that like is new. Actually, let me back up a second, because I'm muddling our like earlier conversation with one we've had on air. So my interpretation of this is that Dany is in the House of the Undying and she sees Rhaegar and Princess Elia. Mm-hmm. And they are celebrating the birth of Prince Aegon. And so Rhaegar thinks that this is his son, as the earlier passage that I read from Maester Aemon. He believed that his son is the prince's promise. And then he says this piece about there must be one more. The dragon has three heads. And so the three-headed dragon of the Targaryen sigil represents Aegon the Conqueror and his two sisters, sister wives, Visenya and Rhaenys. Rhaegar already had his princess Rhaenys and now the prince Aegon. And so I believe he's looking for his Visenya. But a thing that show watchers don't necessarily know is that Princess Elia, who we learn a lot about, because obviously, like, that's the whole reason that the Martells are in the game to begin with from Dorne, has really bad pregnancies. She's really struggles, and she was told that it was unlikely that she would have a third child. Like, it was unlikely she might survive another pregnancy. And so I think Rhaegar genuinely had feelings for Lyanna. I don't think that it was just he was looking for someone to breed with, but I think he genuinely was struck by Lyanna Stark and was looking for his third, his Visenya, to complete his little trio of the three heads of the dragon. that action of looking for that third, the third head of the dragon, regardless of whether you think he's looking for a Visenya or he's looking for a son, maybe a Viserys, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a boy or girl. I'm not getting into that debate. Maybe he was trying to have a little John. But that action kicked off Robert's rebellion. That is one of the reasons that instead of just getting rid of King Aerys, they got rid of the whole Targaryen family, had to go. And so it made me just think of the fact that if this prophecy has been making its way through the generations, if they've all been plagued by it in some way or another, maybe for some of them, they knew the actual prophecy that was passed down. We don't know how this prophecy will end up from Rhaenyra and Jace to future Targaryens. We have no idea at this point.
I do think in that quote, it seems pretty obvious that Rhaegar knew the prophecy.
Right, but how did he? I
don't know.
Yeah,
how they
we
got
know
it.
That they. Yeah. The question is how they got it. Did Rhaegar get it from reading scrolls? Like we've seen Rhaenyra do it. Did he have a dragon dream? Yeah. So that's what I'm really asking here. But we are seeing Targaryens over and over again deplete their numbers and deplete their own family because of this prophecy. The day that Rhaegar was born was the day of the tragedy at Summerhall. That reduced the Targaryen family from maybe like 16 members to about 4. They are in the tragedy of Summerhall, we believe, was that Aegon the Fifth was trying to bring back dragons in some crazy ritual and caused a massive fire that killed many members of his family. So I think we have to just, if we're interested in the lore of this, we have to look at the prophecy through a new lens, which is it may have destroyed the Targaryen dynasty because they were trying to fulfill it.
I agree. And I also think that it starts to make me question, as I said to you offline, how mad the king really was, right? And I know that may sound crazy to some, but, you know, if a prophecy, not saying he didn't get driven to anger or took extreme actions that were not correct, but if a prophecy's been haunting your family, it killed your grandfather, which puts you in the line of succession. It is the thing that's driving your son to go take these extreme actions. And let's be honest, the Targaryens have always had this pact with the Starks, right? This whole a Targaryen on the throne and a Stark in the north. Maybe he just lost it at that point. Maybe he was just like, I'm sick of this prophecy. I'm sick of the Starks. I'm sick of this whole fucking thing. And I'm just going to burn some shit up and burn them all. I'm not saying that he was right. I don't think that he was right. But I'm just saying maybe it's not as crazy as everyone. He wasn't as crazy as what we make him out to be. He maybe had an actual generational reason of understanding something that many people didn't understand. Especially if he had the prophecy, if he knew the prophecy, especially then.
Yeah, I think between the prophecy plus him being tortured for 6 months.
Yeah, for sure.
That certainly to me may have contributed to the Mad King's behavior. I don't know. I mean, again, we're speculating, but at the end of the day, we won't have full answers to any of this until George decides to either just flat out answer them on his not a blog or publish these books.
I vote for the first. I mean, honestly, I just vote for the first. Because
I'm at the point too where I'm like, George, just bullet point us.
Bullet point us. Because honestly, every time I get a CNN alert, my heart is in my throat. I'm like, hey, or I get George R. R. Martin is dropping. I'm like, please give this man vitamins, warmth, good pillows, stay healthy, George. We need this. We need at least the bullet points. We'd love the books, you know? So, Let's talk about a little bit, I think, about other aspects of the magic.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about first, and we'll talk about the dragon riding, but I want to talk first about Helaena's role in the future of the show. Her visions are really clear right now. She understands what's happening. She's showing up in Daemon's visions. I don't know what that means as far as like her abilities. Like, I didn't know transportation was part of this, but that is happening. What are you thinking about this and the way that George kind of approaches prophecy it traditionally? What do you think is going on here with her role?
I think Helena is the stand-in for, like, it is written, it is done. Yeah. Like, yeah. We yeah. are, because I mean, that's basically what she tells Aemon. Aemon is like, I don't like what you said. I could yeah. have you killed. And she's like, okay, bro, like,
yeah,
it's not going to change anything. Like, you are going to die.
Yeah.
And never be heard from again. And I think that when she says that, like, it is what it is, basically, that it kind of underlines a part of what I think George is trying to say. Like, I think choices still matter mm-hmm. in George's world. I really do. But mm-hmm. I think that trying to affect a prophecy often leads to doom. And so I'm really curious about how they're going to play with Helena's character going forward and Aemon's character going forward. Both Aemon and Daemon had their deaths prophesized to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to know how that affects how they move in the world. If you looked me in the face and told me you're going to die in a certain place, I would. The fact that that Alice looked at Daemon and was like, you going to die here. And he stayed. I would have been yeah. on the back of Caraxes so fast.
Yeah, for sure.
And if I'm Aemon, you're telling me I'm going to die in a certain place. I'm never going to that place. I can avoid that prophecy by just me and Vhagar not going there. We're not hanging out there. Why are yeah. we? And so I'm curious to see how this plays out for Aemon, especially. And if we get more of this from Helena, this is the first time that Helena has said very clearly, here's what's going to happen. Now, they left it a little bit vague because it's a massive spoiler. So I feel like book readers don't fully understand what she said. Like, I checked, I mean, not book readers, sorry, show watchers only fully understand what she said. I checked in with a few of them and they said they don't necessarily know, like, understand the significance of what she said. So they kept it a little vague, but she was telling, from Aemon's point of view, he knows what she said.
That show is that what she just did is basically the equivalent of what Joffrey does in Game of Thrones about this whole series. Like, yeah, what she totally. Did, literally the same thing. I'm like, yeah, damn.
So Aemon's character, he knows exactly what she said. So I'm curious to see if we see more of this from Helena. Is like one thing I'm curious about is when Alicent gets back to King's Landing, if she ever goes back, because my girl looked like she was going to wander in the woods for a while.
For sure.
But is she going to have a conversation with her mother to say, here's what happens next? There's all these things you're trying to do. Like, just don't resist anymore. Like, this is what's going to happen. Is she... If Rhaenyra goes to King's Landing, Helena and Rhaenyra will be under the same roof. Yeah. What does that mean? Like, I think they have a real opportunity to use Helena's character in some interesting ways.
Yeah, I'm interested. I kind of want to see how this all plays out with her as well. Based on where I know that her story goes, I want to see how this all plays out and what happens. So somebody who's not in the story, and it indicates something to us, is we've mentioned before, is a character named Nettles. Mm-hmm. And she's not in the show. And, I mean, is the show, this other aspect of magic, is the show telling us now that only Targaryens can ride dragons? Because we do see that there is a Velaryon who's got a dragon. So what do you think the show is saying about dragon riders?
I've been in my feelings about this for a few weeks. So... when Adam claims his dragon, or rather, Sea Smoke claims Adam, mm-hmm. Corlys goes and has this conversation with Alan that's basically like, we don't know that's having Corlys spell out for the audience, we don't know what their background is. Maybe their mother was a dragon seed. It's possible, right? Like, we don't know. And in the book, they kind of make it even more, there's a lot of ways you can interpret this, because one, Adam and Alan are thought to possibly be Laenor's children, not Corlisses. So right there, that would give them Targaryen blood. And it's not clear whether they are or not. It's Mushroom who's like, they're Corlisses kids. But then there's just like, maybe their mother, who in the book, I think her name is Matilda of Hull. Maybe she was a dragon seed. Maybe she, I mean, again, Corlys has a type, maybe. Maybe she also had silver hair. Like, we don't really know. It's not super clear.
Yeah, I mean, more to come, and I hope.
Sorry?
I said more to come, I hope. I hope they give us more context. Basically.
Yeah, and so Nettles is the one character that we're pretty sure does not have Targaryen blood. And the reason for that is both her coloring. She is a brown-skinned, dark-haired young girl. She doesn't appear to be a dragon seed. But furthermore, how she claims this dragon that we believe Rhaena is about to claim, named Sheepstealer, a wild dragon. She does it through befriending the dragon. Mm-hmm. She brings the dragon sheep. And so the show has taken that character away. Fine, whatever. I understand why they have to consolidate, but they've given it to Rhaena, who we know whose last name is literally Targaryen.
Yeah.
And is more Targaryen than most of the other characters on the show. So I'm just wondering, are they trying to, maybe they don't care about this question. Are Targaryens the only ones who can ride dragons? But I feel like Game of Thrones made a very specific decision to let Jon Snow ride Rhaegal.
Yeah.
Because they were confirming that Jon Snow is a Targaryen. So I hope more to come. I'm curious about this.
Me too. Me too. We will see more for sure. I think like I'd go crazy in this, but I was reading some things online earlier today, and there was some like, you know, blowback about Corlys being taken to task for his fathering skills. And how all the fathers are basically trash in Game of Thrones. So why was Corlys the only one taking the task? I will just remind people that this is not the case. That my boy Tywin was also in one of my favorite scenes taken to task by Cersei, who read him for filth about not even seeing his children, even though he talked about legacy and called him out on his shit, and. You know, there's some others. I think as well that have done similar things on the show. I won't go into all the details, but I don't think it was exclusive to Corlys and Adams. So I felt compelled to say that because I saw some of the discourse, and I get it because, you know, just keeping it real, like, you know, this is kin folklore for a reason. We don't want to continue the narrative of like, you know, negative stereotypes around black fatherhood because there are a lot of really good black fathers. And there is the way to take that and read it that way. But I just wanted to keep it even and just say, hey, no, I do remember Tywin being called out by his kids. Well, mainly Cersei, to be honest, in a way that I thought. And Tyrion in some cases, but not to the level that Adam was. But definitely he also was calling him out about when he wanted him to, like, sleep with Sansa, and he's like, you just killed her brother. How the fuck am I supposed to do that? Right? That's not really going to make it. So I think there's some things about checking him and how he's treated him, but this is a particularly interesting story trope that I think reasonably people got triggered by. But I do think there's some other cases where fathers are being called out, and Westeros has pretty much the most trash fathers in all of fantasy.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah. It's really bad.
I'm like really trying to think of like a good father. I think Ned has a lot of the staples of good fatherhood. So Ned did some other trash stuff, but I'll let him have
it. I'm not giving it to him. You know why I'm not giving it to him? Because I remember that he had to be compelled by Varys in the dungeons when he said, you grew up with actors. I grew up with warriors. I learned to die a long time ago. And Varys had to say, yes, but what of your children? What about them? Like, what happens to them when you die here being honorable? Like, and I think that he was, you know, Ned had a lot of things that The fandom may not know I have a whole take. The whole podcast could be done on my takes on Ned Stark. Like, trust me, I do not think he was as honorable as people make him out to be. There were some good things he did. He did have honor. That doesn't make him a bad person. But I do think there's that some of his actions were read by the realm a certain way when I read them differently. So anyway, I will say I don't necessarily think Ned would have made the best choices there either. And probably should have thought differently about how he moved, knowing that his daughters were in the capital. How he confronted Cersei should have been different.
Yeah, he made some errors in that way, but I think in just thinking about the treatment of his kids,
sure.
You know, I think he is quite far ahead of Corlys because Jon is allegedly his bastard, and Jon is one of his kids, like. He didn't leave him outside. Corlys is given Roose Bolton with this one.
Yeah, and that's another person. There's the other person that stood up to their father. Like, Ramsay Bolton killed fucking Roose Bolton. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, that's another person that was like, yeah, dude, I don't really hear what you got to say, and killed him. So, like, again, you're right. And he is given Roose Bolton. That was the father I was leaving out because I hate the Boltons. But, yeah.
And the thing that's crazy about Roose, like, Corlys had an heir.
Mm-hmm.
He had a son. Roose did not.
Yeah.
And he was still like, the way he talks about Ramsay and in the book is wild.
Roose is the worst.
Yeah, it is wild. I mean, we have no respect for Roose Bolton in folklore, but like, yeah. So I hear you. I saw some of that too. I understand why people feel that way. They have every right to feel that way.
100%.
I agree. I largely agree with you because I think Tywin, in some of my favorite scenes, like, got red for Felf. So
yeah, and again, like, that's so to clarify, to be really clear, like, I agree with what you just said too, and there's a real reason to feel the way that to raise the point and the issue that people are raising, and I understand where it's coming from, and I rock with that motivation. I was just wanted to balance the conversation with, like, yeah, there's some real trash dads that also get read for filth on the show. So that's all. But let's talk about other small folk. Let's talk about Missaria, and I think that'll close us out before we get to the spoiler section.
Yeah, I guess I just want to ask you. Some alarm bells went off.
Yeah.
With Missaria in the final few episodes. And then I was thinking back to, like, her earlier actions. And I'm like, oh, my, I'm concerned about this woman now. So I think we've talked at length that I mostly have thought that she's being sincere. But I was really struck by her conversation with Rhaenyra in the finale, where Rhaenyra is like, you know, I don't really want to burn down Old Town and Lannisport.
Yeah.
Like, I would prefer not to do that. And Missaria is like, no, you should do it. you know that you are just. You know that you did the right thing with the red sewing. Like, she's basically... Like, either Missaria is buying into the hype of Rhaenyra because of how she feels about Rhaenyra, that she's drank the Rhaenyra Kool-Aid, or she has some other motive here. But, like, the notion that she would be so careless about the small folk in Lannisport and Old Town, that she doesn't, like, she cares about the small folk up until, like, Rhaenyra's like, actually, we're going to have to murder a bunch of them. Like, I wanted to get your take on it.
Maybe it's certain small folk she cares about. Maybe she cares about the small folk in King's Landing. She knows them. She's been with them. And maybe Old Town is representative of an oppressive religious thing that has shamed her and talked about people that she cares about in a way that she doesn't respect. So just because she's, like, all for the small folk, my take on it, I guess, is that she's also, like, selective in, like, her loyalties. And yeah, she could be playing Rhaenyra, but I definitely don't think that she's, I think that Old Town represents for a lot of people in this world, like, the same thing that religion being like the magisterium or religion being oppressive. And I think, like, yes, they are the freaking banner children for the Seven. So burning down Old Town for a person who was like a madam who wasn't had their own pleasure house that burned to the ground, that was done by the High Towers, who are one of the representative families of Old Town, who have the High Tower on their freaking sigil. I think that comes down to her just being like, I don't fucking like those people. That's what it comes down to.
Well,
the Lannisters are right in with them.
Okay, I don't know. I don't trust her.
I don't trust her either. But I just
think
she's
gone from
them.
Being like, "Oh, okay, she's." I don't know. Something's just like off about that last conversation they had, because everyone responded when Rhaenyra's like, "Yeah, we might have to burn down Lannisport." Everyone had the appropriate reaction except for Jace, who's just like, I'm a backup mom.
Yeah.
Then she's having this conversation about her doubts. And like, in fairness, Corlys is also like, listen, we got to do it. We got to strike first, because Aemon is just going to keep burning down our bannermen's houses until he gets his way. But just having Missaria, who is the person who's been like the champion of the small folk, be like, yeah, I guess, you know, you're just, so you got to strike. Like, let's sacrifice a few thousand people to win the war. It's rough. It's rough.
Yeah, yeah. No question. It's not great. But I just think that, yeah, I just think it comes down to, I just think she just doesn't like him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, and maybe the way she's framing it is, it's like, some small folk are going to have to die, but it doesn't have to. We can end this conflict if a few thousand people die instead of a million. You know, like, it's rough though. So I just wanted your take on it.
Yeah, no question. I think it's rough too. I definitely agree with you on that. That it's not the best tack, but I mean, we got our eye on Missaria anyway. I mean, she's gonna have something to juggle here now with the moments that she's had with Rhaenyra, and the fact that Daemon and her are back boot up, and that she's kind of like there with both of them. You know what I mean? Like, let's see what's gonna happen here. You know?
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to have Daemon back in the fold. Missaria does not like this man.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, I guess we can talk a little bit about. I want to go into the Allison and Rhaenyra stuff in our spoiler section, because I want to talk a little bit about that. But yeah, let's say thank you all for listening. And for this season, it's been so fun. My gosh. Like, if you don't want to listen to any of the spoiler stuff we're going to talk about, we just want to say a proper thank you for all of your participation in the season, and for watching and listening and messaging us. It's just been a blast. So thank you all.
Yeah, I want to echo that. We always have fun with this show.
Yeah.
So it's been amazing. Thank you to everyone.
So with that, if you don't want spoilers, you know, go get out of here, you know, like go ahead. You can leave now. We're about to start. We're going to let you leave. Okay. All right. I think they've probably paused, turned off, ran to wherever they need to do the hit stop. So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think we kick off the season with Rhaenyra taking King's Landing?
Yes.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. I don't see how they can delay it, because they're basically, Alicent told her to come on the third day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that third day might very well coincide with whenever the Triarchy gets there.
Yeah.
But I think Rhaenyra is going to take King's Landing and then learn about the Triarchy after she's taken it, or as she's taken it.
Okay, so she's going to find out about the Triarchy as she's taking it, and she's also probably going to find out about Aegon being gone. Do you think she's going to feel like she was lied to? I think so.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I don't see how Alicent... I don't see how Alicent gets out of this one with Rhaenyra, because unless she's got, like, the down to the minute when Larys and Aegon left, it's going to look like Aegon and Larys left, or, you know, maybe they won't care about Larys, but Aegon left, and then Rhaenyra headed off to Dragonstone. I mean, sorry, Alicent headed off to Dragonstone, so that she was never acting in good faith.
Yeah,
I don't know how Rhaenyra is going to react to this. Maybe she'll believe Alicent. Maybe she won't. But I think they're planting the seeds that a bunch of stuff is going to go terribly wrong when Rhaenyra tries to take King's Landing, in terms of her relationship with Alicent. And maybe Helaena gets caught up with that.
It's possible. I think that she's definitely gonna be upset, because she knows that her legitimacy in the reign of her, like, it's gonna be dependent on her taking Aegon out completely to rule, and she says so. So that's gonna be, and that was the deal, you know, a son for a son. Once again, they made that deal, and once again, this does not look like it's gonna go through. I do think her son is going to find, the son that escapes is going to find his dragon still alive as they're on their way.
Yeah. But what the hell are they doing with Sunfire? Do you think they overdid it with the Sunfire is dead stuff?
Yeah, they did, because in the book, Sunfire is just really wounded and can't fly, and everybody knows that Sunfire is still alive. And so then it's just, and people actually are wounded trying to, like, care for him. And then eventually they get there and then the dragon's gone. One day they show up and the dragon's gone, right? So I think that's going to become Larys and Aegon's mission. They're starting out with the idea that they're going, you know, in the direction that they're going. And then they're going to see that Sunfire is gone. And I think that's going to prompt Aegon and Larys to probably go looking for the dragon. And because Aegon loves Sunfire, and he's not going to want to leave knowing that Sunfire is still alive.
I wondered if they're going to make it to Essos.
I don't think so.
And then Sunfire is going to show up.
I don't think they make it to Essos.
I don't either, but I wonder if that... Because they need to park Aegon somewhere believable, and it can't be Dragonstone. So I think they have... Like, I'm trying to rack my brain. Where else are these guys going to go?
Well, they're saying that he's going to sit on a wooden throne. Could it be the Driftwood throne?
I don't see how Corlys doesn't go back. I don't know. I just think it's curious. I like what they're doing. I think they may have overdone the Sunfire thing, because now I think there's an element of when they do reveal that Sunfire is alive and well, that people are going to be like, you tricked us, because there's been just so much like, Sunfire is long in the dying. My dragon is dead. Like, just a lot of reminders that Sunfire is allegedly dead. It just seems a little bit like overkill to me.
Somebody should have killed that dragon.
I mean,
yes. Somebody should have killed Sunfire. While Sunfire was wounded, somebody should have figured out a way to go finish the job. Like, honestly.
I actually saw something interesting. There's a theory kicking around the fandom that Sunfire is dead. And it's because they don't want to kill Rhaenyra the way that she dies in the book.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't like it.
I hate that.
Yeah, I do think that Condal is still deciding. what he's going to do with Sunfire. Just like, I think he's still deciding.
Yeah, I think you got to kill. I think you got to kill her like that way. It's in the lore. It's in the fucking other show. It's very clear that, I mean, you're in the spoiler section. You already know this. It's very clear that Rhaenyra gets eaten by Aegon's dragon. Okay. It's like in the lore a million times over. And it's like the thing that like leads to the downfall of the dragons ultimately, because that crazy psychopath Aegon III freaking poisons a bunch of dragons because he's like, oh, my mommy died. I'm sorry. Like, the Aegons just need, the Aegons are the problem with this family line. Okay.
I have mixed feelings about, I agree with you that it has to happen. I just don't feel like they've put the, I don't think they've put all the pieces in place. Aegon is like a toddler.
Yeah, they're going to have to, it's going to take a while. Like next season is going to take, he's not going to take the throne right away. It's going to take a little while. This is what I'm saying. Like, they have at least two, this is why everybody's mad about the pacing. They have at least two seasons, maybe even three, if they do it the right way.
They've confirmed that they're doing four seasons total. I don't want to say this on the main pod, but like, I have concerns about things that they might have to cut out for budgetary reasons, for that they just didn't put the pieces in place for timing. Like, Aegon and Viserys are too young.
Yeah, they got to age them up.
How are they going to age them up? I just don't think we have time for that.
They're going to have to do another time jump. They're going to have to age them up. There's no way around it. They're going to have to age them up.
So, okay. To get us back on track here. So, the gullet.
Yeah.
Obviously, and nobody jumping on the back of Stormcloud. Like, that's, so that piece of the gullet can't happen.
Yeah.
But all the other pieces of the gullet are in place, right? We have our Triarchy fleet heading towards the Valyrian fleet. Mm-hmm. You know, we have Jace and his feelings about basically everything. But we have this issue of young Aegon and Stormcloud. Mm-hmm. And the issue of literally baby Viserys, who is like a baby. My theory is that with Rhaena in the mix with her dragon, that's how she's able to save one of the kids. She can't save them both, but she saves toddler Aegon. But otherwise, I'm like, how is this going to work? Like,
I think after the gullet, after Jace dies, after, which is going to send Rhaenyra through the roof, while I think that there, after that point, there is room to, you know, taking of King's Landing, the gullet happens. There's room here then to have, like, especially when the kids are kidnapped, to shift to like have like time passage in the battles and how long the war is taking, and kind of play with that a little bit to age up the kids little by little, because you still have to get to Joffrey, you still got to get to all the stuff that's going to happen with him in King's Landing, all that stuff has to happen.
Joffrey is just old enough and just immature enough that I do think it's believable that he would jump on the back of his mother's dragon.
Yeah.
I'm not as concerned about Joffrey. I wish he wasn't so little, but like, not as concerned. I'm much more concerned about the younger kids because they are important.
Yeah.
I mean, they're both going to be king. Like,
they're
super important. And I just think that all the other pieces for the gullet are in place, except for the kids are too young. And I just don't think they can do a significant time jump, given that Rhaenyra is going to have to either take King's Landing within 3 days, or if even if she takes it after the gullet, like the triarchy's already on their way. Or, it's not going to take the triarchy 2 years.
That's how they can do it. That's how they can do it. The triarchy stuff gets stretched out. They have more battles than just the gullet. And then the gullet actually, then they turn it, the gullet, into the battle. Like that takes that. So this can happen further down the line. So King's Landing happens. Rhaena claims the dragon. Claiming the dragon, they're able to stay at in over there before they have to make the journey. She then agrees to take them across on the journey. That happens, like, maybe not right away, but, like, goes down the line. They could, like, stretch it out. Different than the books, for sure, but they could stretch it out where they stay in the Vale longer now that they have a dragon.
But okay, that makes sense. That if she catches up with the with the little mini caravan taking the kids.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense.
And so they stretch it out a little bit more, and that maybe gets us to get Aegjum up a little bit. And then finally, you know, Rhaena's like, I need to take them, you know, and convinces Lady Jane that she has to take them. And then there we go. You know what I mean? Like, that's what happens.
And that would keep Harry Collett on the show longer. And I think that's what they want to do.
Exactly.
Because he is their most viral breakout. Like, he's on the show. I don't think he's that much of a breakout character. I think we got to know him and Bela, Jason Bela, a lot better.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, their social media approach, I think he's one of their best assets.
I agree. No, I agree. And I think they got to keep him on the show as long as they possibly can, which changes when they maybe want to do the gullet. And I think that they can stretch out the sea war with the sea snake and all of that a lot longer. And it also gives Alan a chance to show Alan and Adam in action. It gives them a real chance to show Alan, like, at sea, becoming what he's going to become, which is the person who is the head of House Velaryon moving forward.
And I also think it gives a chance for Rhaena to figure out how she's going to control a dragon that has never been trained.
Yes.
Like, Sheep Stealer is not just going to know Velaryon. She's not, the regular commands are not going to work on a wild dragon. So, okay, that makes sense. I feel a little bit better about that. I do think that we will get the fish feed, like, right away.
Yeah.
Because all season, the Lannisters are on the march. All right, let's see it then. Come on. Let's go. I think we get the fish feed in, like, episode one or two.
And I also think we're here to die for the Dragon Queen.
We better fucking get it. Okay. If I don't get my favorite line from this book in that, like, Yorkshire accent of the Northmen, I will be really mad. I need to have the "we're here to die, we came to die for the Dragon Queen." Like, I need it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Okay, so I think that next season we'll get the fish feed, the gullet, the taking of King's Landing. I'm not sure about, like, Tumbleton or any, but I do think Kristen Cole is going to go out in next season.
Yeah, I think we might get Tumbleton. And I also think that we're not going to get what I'm pretty clear about now is I don't think we get the God's Eye battle until season four.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think we're lucky if we get the God's Eye before the middle of season four.
Yeah, agreed.
I think they're going to want to keep Aemon and Daemon on the chessboard as long as humanly possible, which means, I mean, I think a real question we have to ask ourselves, and I was talking to Dan, one of our listeners, about this earlier in the week, is, like, do we get the Hour of the Wolf? And remember when we first talked about this show before it was even on, I said, I don't see how they get to the Hour of the Wolf because I just don't feel strongly that people are going to care about the show long after their main characters are gone. Once Daemon and Rhaenyra are gone and most of their kids are gone, I mean, we'll still have Rhaena and Bela. I just don't see how we get the aftermath I think that's the title of the chapter, right? Isn't it called The Aftermath?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think if we do get it, it's going to be very short and it won't be its full glory. And I'll be straight with you. That was my favorite part of this whole story.
I think we do get The Hour of the Wolf, because I think that they've committed to four seasons. It will depend on what we do as fans and watching it. But I think we get The Hour of the Wolf. I think we get a short and condensed version of The Hour of the Wolf. But I think
You're thinking like Rhaenyra. Let's just map it out for season four. So let's assume God's Eye is episode 3. Rhaenyra dies in episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the Baratheons get King's Landing under control. I think they might skip over all of the, like, you know, random kings who pop up.
Yeah.
All the little pretenders, Targaryen pretenders. So I think I definitely think we'll get Aegon being poisoned, all of that stuff. Like, I think all that will happen. And then maybe in episode like 6, we get a full episode that's The Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, because in season 3, we're going to introduce a bunch of new characters. They're going to introduce Blackwood. She's going to be in that, you know, she's going to be in it, because they're going to have to introduce that. So that whole thing with her and Craig and
Black Alley.
Yeah. Black Alley. So that whole happens. They're going to have to introduce, I think personally the season, the show ends with Corlys's death, like walking up the stairs, like one of the close to the end things. It ends close to, like, it doesn't get into all the Viserys and Aegon the Third stuff. Like, when Viserys, you gotta bring Viserys has to come home, and I mean that has to happen. Like, they can't leave Viserys just lost. He's the future of the freaking house.
I agree.
So that has to happen. Corlys counseling Aegon has to happen. Right before he passes, and the loss of the hand, because he's such a pivotal part of it. So I think season 4, we lose Matt Smith. We lose a lot of people. We lose Matt Smith. We lose Daemon. We lose Rhaenyra. We lose Corlys. And we have Craigan bring order to the city, and you see the future of the house. We probably even see Viserys' return and the upheaval where they have to, like, take a stand against the people who are trying to overthrow them. And then it ends, like, you know, with one of them on the throne, you know, with Aegon on the throne.
Yeah, I think we won't get the stuff about, I forget her name, but the Valarian cousin that...
Yeah, no.
Vaemond's daughter. I don't think we'll get that. I think if there's a marriage pact at the end of this, which they could just totally skip, I would be totally fine with that.
Me too.
But if there's a marriage pact at the end of this, it will be the young Jaehaera,
and
maybe we don't actually, I mean, the kids are too young to actually have them marry, so I think we'll just get Jaehaera. But I'm also fine if they just leave that ambiguous. Like, I don't think it's that important. Like, if people really want that piece of the Targaryen family tree, they can go read the books. Like, so I don't think it's important to be depicted on the show. I do. The one thing I disagree with you on is I don't think the show ends with the death of Corlys. I think it ends with the death of Alicent.
Oh, that's fair. I can see that.
Yeah, but I think Corlys's final days are going to be important. Also think, like, they showed us this season. I know a lot of people are like they've focused too much on Rhaenyra and Alicent, and that takes away from the rest of the cast and the rest of the characters. But come on, Baela had not that many scenes, and people are out here ready to die for her. I think, like, Baela, Rhaena, Corlys, certainly Aegon, like, they can carry the show after Rhaenyra is dead.
Yeah, and I'm also not so sure that we only get 4 seasons. I know they're saying that to everybody. I think, like, it really is going to be, like, I'd be okay if we only do 4, but I really do think it comes down to how it's going next season, whether or not they will extend them for one more season, or whether they'll have one season to wrap it all up.
I don't really see it right now based on the ratings. Yeah, I think we're lucky if HBO actually finishes the story. I think HBO will finish it because they'll look dumb if they don't.
Yeah.
But I think the ratings are not great, and the way the fandom reacted to the finale, I think some people are not coming back next season.
Well, A Knight of Seven Kingdoms can also fill in some gaps too between.
I know, but it's. I think the same people who were pissed about the finale are going to hate A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because it's just not the large scale conflict that people really liked about Game of Thrones. I just think these are different stories, and while if you love this world, you'll love all the stories the way that we do, but they're not similar. Like, they have similarities, there are themes that are recurrent in all of them. Obviously George R. R. Martin wrote all of them, but like, they have a different feel, they have different, you know, points. Like, he's trying to say something different with every story, and so if people are expecting like Game of Thrones type material with all of these spinoffs, they're just not going to get it. You will continue to be disappointed, because I don't think that's the point. And I think that's actually great, because if we're just looking at Star Wars, and I'm not a Star Wars fan, so I'm not super engaged in that fandom, but like, my understanding is that the different modes of storytelling, the different types of story from the same universe, have actually added so much to the texture of the world.
Yeah.
So I'm totally fine if some stories, like we've been saying, we would be fine with a Downton Abbey-esque Jaehaerys and Alysanne just running the kingdom.
I'm ready to go.
Like, if you love this world, then you have to get used to the fact that like, not everything is going to be the type of show that Game of Thrones is. Like, and that should be fine. We're learning about different families, different parts of this world, small folk. Like, it's just disheartening to see how people are like, oh, this sucks because it's not exactly like the other thing that we got that also sucked.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be, because these are different times, different people, different scenarios, and based on different historical events. And so, like, I agree with you. I think you just have to, like, take your time, enjoy the world, enjoy what it's like. I feel like the Knight of Seven Kingdoms is going to be like, you know, Arya and the Hound, like, on a buddy cop adventure. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I think about it. And it'll have the backdrop of all the other crazy, like, the stuff happening in King's Landing. But it's not going to be about King's Landing. It's going to be about these adventures of a hedge knight and his squire. You know what I mean? Like, and that's okay. You know what I mean?
Totally.
I'm okay with that. Anyway, well, that will do it for House of the Dragon Season 2. We just appreciate you. Thank you for listening. If you've gone this far, you are definitely the true blue fans who have listened to every single freaking podcast, but also have read the books and don't care about spoilers. We appreciate y'all, all every fan that listens to the podcast and enjoys the show. Stay in touch with us. We'll be back. We're not going to announce what we're covering yet. Still talking about what we're going to cover next. But yeah, we will be back. And, you know, hit us up, kinfolklore@gmail.com, kinfolklorepod on Instagram, kinfolklorepod on Twitter, and Ken Folklore on TikTok. We will see you in the next season.
Bye, everyone.